I'm Kirk Salveson. I work in the kitchen. I spent last semester studying in Mexico. I spent 4.5 months in Mexico and also spent some time in Guatemala and in Nicaragua. I was with a program from Augsburg College, a semester in global communities. We studied economics, liberation theology, Spanish, and Mexican history. Our time in Nicaragua, we spent there trying to find out what the reality of the Nicaraguan Revolution is, what the people feel about it. We visited a variety of people that were most affected by the revolution, as well as the people that are making the revolution go now, the government officials. I'll make a short presentation, about 25 minutes or so, then we'll open it up for questions. But first of all, I'd like to know what you know about Nicaragua. What have you heard about it this last spring? It seems to be in the news quite a bit. Where do you read most of the stuff that you read about Nicaragua? Could we just open it up? Anything.
One of the issues on which the National Council of Churches was criticized because of their help to the literacy program in Nicaragua.
Okay.
On 60 Minutes.
Right. Well, I remember the revolution when the Sandinistas took over the government, which was only a couple of years ago.
All right.
Nicaragua is criticized by the United States government for not having elections.
Okay, no elections.
I was interested to discover that the support to the counter revolution by the CIA, I had read about that in some alternative press like a year and a half before it finally showed up in Newsweek. So I tend to believe some of that alternative press right now.
Any others? Did anyone read anything about when the Pope came to Central America, about what happened? Seemed I read a lot about it when I was in Mexico. What did you read?
One of the things was they didn't arrange for a cross to be put up on the altar, and then it was a very politically manipulated event, and the Pope was very angry and held his cross up high and just had some words with Escobar, one of the cabinet ministers who's a priest. He refused to kiss his.
He did kiss his ring, but the Pope shook his
ring. Oh, that was it,
Ernesto Cardinal.
Cardinal, that was it. Mm-hmm. I don't know how true all that was, but that's
what it happened. Any others? Okay. Well, I won't deal with all of those in the presentation, but we can certainly ask those questions afterwards and see what I can say about them. I'll start with the short history of Nicaragua. Nicaragua was colonized by the Spanish in the 1500s, as was all of South America and Central America. In Nicaragua, the domination of the Spanish seemed to be mostly on the western half of the country here. There's mountains here. The Spanish seemed to dominate this half, while the British dominated the eastern half, the British going off to Great Britain. I'm going to go up to 1900 now. We just did 300 years and 20 seconds, but we want to get to the meat of the revolution here. In 1900, the United States, or around that period of 1900, the United States began to be interested in Nicaragua, partially because they saw it as a possible place to put in a canal, an interoceanic canal. In fact, one government was thrown out in the late 1800s because they were negotiating with Japan about the canal. The United States said, we don't want that. And to display the seriousness of their commitment, Marines occupied Nicaragua from 1912 to 1925, and then again from 1926 to 1933. During those years, especially in the last few years of the occupation, the United States set up, armed, financed a National Guard that would take the Marines' places when the Marines left. That National Guard was to keep the peace in Nicaragua and to keep the people in order so nothing would happen. And they did that. In 1933, when the Marines left and the National Guard began its stronghold of the nation, it brought to power a 45-year family dynasty, the family dynasty of the Somozas. The Somozas began in 1933, and then it ended in July 19th of 1979. It started with Anastasio Somoza Garcia. I'll say a few things about him, just to give you an idea of what type of ruler he was and his sons continued to be. FDR said about him, "He may be an SOB, but he's our SOB." When he went to Costa Rica, and not FDR, but Anastasio Somoza, when he went to Costa Rica at one time, he was told about the educational programs of Costa Rica. And he reportedly said, "I don't want people, I want oxen." Later on, from 1957 to 67, his son took rule of Nicaragua, and the same thing happened, basically. It was a government of corruption, payoffs for the rich, basically oppressing the poor people of Nicaragua. The last Somoza took power in 1967 until 1979, and probably one incident that you all remember is the 1972 earthquake in Managua, where millions of dollars in food, medical, and economic aid poured into Nicaragua. But we were told many times of how none of this ever reached the people. It was said that although much of this aid was pouring in, it never reached the people until possibly a month later, when the National Guard hit the streets with the supplies and began selling them to the people. And just before the overthrow of the Somoza government in 1979, Somoza bombed many of his own industries with the Air Force of Nicaragua. But on July 19th of 1979, the popular insurrection of the Nicaraguan people prevailed. A new government was put into power, a government that was in the interests of the impoverished majority of Nicaragua. This government tried to set up a new type of government for Central America, a government that would explore a third option. When I speak of a third option, I'm speaking capitalism versus communism, something besides these two options, a new vision for a government in Central America. And so they began on a very, very different course from other governments that have come to power in Central America. First of all, They first of all did two things when they came into power. They abolished the death penalty, which is quite amazing when we think of Central America. We think of what's happening in Central America now, death squads roaming, secret trials, stuff like this. This is all happening in El Salvador and in Guatemala. But Nicaragua, the first thing they did was abolish the death penalty. And this has come back to haunt them, because many of the people that they have let free are now in Honduras, are now in Costa Rica, and are now fighting the Nicaraguans and killing their own people. The second thing they did was they expropriated all of Somoza's assets, land, industry, everything. And suddenly this new government had control of 20% of the land of Nicaragua. Now, they didn't know what to do with it, so they began an agrarian reform. But that gives you an idea of how much land or how much control the Somoza family had over Nicaragua. It was like a huge plantation, the whole country. This young and inexperienced government went into power and began these reforms. And I want to emphasize the young and inexperienced portion of that statement. These are very, very young people. We talked to the second man in the North American division of their State Department, who was 23 years old, second person in charge. Nicaragua does not have 200 years of diplomatic history behind it. It doesn't have all of the smooth and the greased gears that we have. It's very rough. Sometimes one wonders, you know, what are they doing? Sometimes they do very dumb things, to be quite honest. But then again, that comes out of this inexperience that I think that Nicaragua has. being a government of almost 4 years old. Nicaragua began an agrarian reform where 12,000 people received land in the first year. Although that's kind of a catchphrase, it seems that everyone began a great agrarian reform in their first year. Nicaragua does have an agrarian reform where people are getting land through government cooperatives, government farms, and also the private sector also reigns in Nicaragua. The private sector does control 65% of the economy. Nicaragua also set up a mixed economy. When I talk about mixed economy, I mean a mix between the government sector and the private sector. They also began an economic system where they would redistribute the staple products of Nicaragua. They would distribute them to all the people, regardless of wealth. So some people in Nicaragua began to get sugar for the first time in their lives. Nicaragua also began a literacy campaign. It was probably one of the most amazing literacy campaigns ever attempted to this day. Highly successful. It brought literacy from 48% to 87% in the first year of the new government. Also, they executed a health campaign that was that was done by volunteers. I'm really sorry. So much for inclusive language. Their health campaign was staffed. Thank you. Staffed by volunteers. They vaccinated people against polio, measles, tuberculosis, and malaria. The new government built the first road that connected the east coast to the west coast. The new government also brought water to many neighborhoods, brought pavement to many neighborhoods. And also while doing all these public work projects, Nicaragua assumed a $1.6 billion debt that had been incurred before 1979. This was all a Somoza debt. They assumed this, renegotiated the loans, and have met all payments on this loan. While doing this, they also lowered inflation from 84% to 27% in the first 18 months, and in the first 18 months, unemployment went from 40% to 16%. There are a few facts about what happened after the revolution in Nicaragua. Now let's take a look at the United States response. It seems that the United States has taken a two-pronged approach to the Nicaraguan problem. It seems that there's a covert action and an overt action. The covert action is one that we've all heard about. It's been splattered all over the pages of Newsweek, a $20 million covert war from Honduras against Nicaragua. This is supposedly CIA perpetrated. And this $20 million is using the old National Guard members in hit-and-run attacks on the border of Nicaragua, the border of Honduras and Nicaragua, as you can see it on the map. We were on the border, on the northwestern corner. We talked to some people who had been on the border, people who lived on the border, people who had been forced to move off the border because of the attacks. And I remember one particular Newsweek, April 11th of this spring, 1983, where the reporter went out with the Somocista bands, the bands that are fighting against Nicaragua, and he said that they paid for all the food that they bought from the people, but we couldn't find anyone who had ever been paid for the person that had been killed, the cow that had been killed, their wife that had been raped, or anything like that. The overt action seems to be the destabilization of the Nicaraguan government, and part of the destabilization takes place from the hit-and-run attacks, the constant destabilization, the prodding of the Nicaraguan government. But also on top of that, the overt action takes place in the blocking of loans, the blocking of food aid, and the blocking of economic aid. President Carter sent $70 million to Nicaragua in 1979 to, or in 1980, to avoid radicalization of the government. Upon the inauguration of Ronald Reagan, he froze $40 million of that loan that had not been paid out. He then canceled $17.6 million in AID programs for purchasing of wheat and cooking oil. And that was eventually, the wheat was supplied then by many of our allies, such as Sweden, Canada, Argentina, France, and West Germany, as well as the Soviet Union, Cuba, and East Germany. And it ended up, instead of being a shortage problem for Nicaragua, it became a supply problem. We have also trained Somocistas, the people that are fighting against Nicaragua in the United States, which violates neutrality treaties. And we also vetoed a World Bank loan and an Inter-American Bank loan for the Nicaraguan fishing fleet. It was also attempted in January of 1982 to blow up Nicaragua's only cement plant and petroleum plant. This was supposedly perpetrated by the CIA. The war against Nicaragua not only is fought in Nicaragua and in Honduras, but it is also fought here in the United States through campaigns of misrepresentations of fact, deliberate deception, and double standards. I'd like to give a couple examples of those. One double standard is, I'm taking this from the National Catholic Reporter of May 27, 1983. When a State Department official was asked why the Reagan administration was not pressing the El Salvadoran government harder to bring to justice the killers of four United States American church women, the analyst said the administration could not lean any harder without interfering with El Salvador's sovereignty or the government's right as a justly constituted government under the law. Yet no analyst applies the same standards to the United States' overt and covert action against Nicaragua. The Reagan administration also uses elections. Many times we see Nicaragua is not having elections. We cannot support a government that has shot its way into power. But this seems also to be a double standard. As we look at the government of Chile, the Reagan administration has used elections and human rights as a kind of a whipping post against Nicaragua. But Augusto Pinochet in Chile has said that at the very earliest, I will have elections in 1989 or 1981, or 1991, excuse me, somewhere in that period of time. And I think we know what the human rights situation in Chile is, yet there has been no recrimination of the Reagan administration or the State Department against Chile. Nicaragua is also said to be infecting the area with communism and is destabilizing the area through a military buildup. But we seldom look at the Honduran military buildup. Lost my page, excuse me. Nicaragua has four helicopters, three training jets, and a couple military transport planes, and an army of 25,000 people, which is the largest army in Central America. Honduras is a close second, a few thousand people behind that. Honduras has the most powerful air force in Central America with 18 modern jets and 20 helicopters. In 1982, Honduras was second in military aid assistance in Central America. $10.5 million in addition to the lease of 20 helicopter gunships and six A-37 jet fighter planes. Ronald Reagan also asked for $17.5 million more in military assistance, as well as $35 million more in economic support funds as part of the Caribbean Basin Initiative. In 1983, Ronald Reagan wants $21 million for the airbase upgrading of three airbases near Nicaragua, $25 million in economic support funds, $15 million in weapons and training. And this does not include the $20 million that is going in covert action. In total, $144 million security-related assistance in 1982 and 83 to Honduras, a tenfold increase over 1980. Nicaragua seems to have political freedom. Nicaragua seems to have religious freedom. Nicaragua seems to have human rights. Then why are we against Nicaragua, I guess, is the question that we should be asking next. And as I see it, Nicaragua is a battle of ideologies. Nicaragua is a light to other Central American countries. Other Central American countries such as El Salvador, the guerrillas in El Salvador, the guerrillas in Guatemala, see Nicaragua, and they see that a revolution can prevail. And that is the light to other Central American countries. They're saying we can overcome. We can overcome this oppression. We will fight to the end. And this is the light that is shining to other Central American countries, that an oppression, a dictator can be overthrown. If this does happen, if these other revolutions prevail in Central America, in Guatemala, in El Salvador, this means a large loss for us as, or I should say, in corporate interests of the United States. So the Reagan administration, as I see it, would like one of three things. There are one of three options for the Nicaraguan problem. It's either reform the Sandinista government, the government in Nicaragua, reform that government to a more acceptable government towards the United States, or destabilize the Sandinista government and put in a new dictator. Or the third option is continue to destabilize Nicaragua, continue to push them further and further to the left so that Nicaragua has to restrict more and more freedoms. Freedom of the press, freedom of the people, freedom of political meetings. Keep pushing them so they have to move further and further to the left, and eventually they will become something of a Cuba. And we can say, look, you can't be a third option. You can only be with us or against us. There is no third option. Look, they turned into a Cuba. So there's no third option. Finally, I think we asked the question, this title of the session is, can we believe Time Magazine? And I think the answer is, yes, we can some of the time, and no, we can't a lot of the time. It prints a lot of half-truths. There is truth there, but I think some of the time, a lot the other side, or there isn't the whole truth there. We need different sources of news. We need to read reporting from the affected areas. We need to read reporting of the people. We need to read reports from the people that are being affected by this situation. And to close, I'd like to read a little bit from the June 3rd, 1983 Christian Science Monitor. This is from a man who was a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and was assisting managing editor of the Washington Post, and has just released a book, The Media Monopoly. He asserts that 50 large corporations now control the majority of America's print and broadcast media. These owners, he says, restrict what news is presented to the public either overtly or covertly in order to guard their own interests. Among his findings, 20 newspaper chains now control more than half the daily newspaper sales. 20 corporations have just over 50% of the annual magazine sales. 10 corporations have half of the audience for commercial radio. 11 firms received over half of the $7 billion in book sales in 1980. Board members of major newspapers and TV networks have also served on boards of the largest United States corporations. Later, he says, some subjects, some ideas will have more trouble getting in, not because of their inherent nature, but because it will be offensive to the owners. In the end, there is a different flow into society of ideas and certain subject matter, and that distorts the total picture. A survey by the American Society of Newspaper Editors found that 33% of all editors working for newspaper chains said they wouldn't feel free to run a story that would be damaging to their parent firms. I think a reporter who works for a commercial publication has had the experience of having a story killed because it offends the publisher or the interests of the owner. And finally, he says, to get any kind of coherent view of what's happening in society, you must have access to non-major media. That's all I'd like to say right now. We can open it up for questions. I didn't deal with the arms flow to El Salvador, the Pope, elections, religious freedom, political freedom. We can deal with any of those. Go ahead.
Projecting ahead, is it fair to say that the, like the rebels in El Salvador or whatever, do they have the same philosophy that the people who took over Nicaragua? Is it a favorable comparison between the two? So many people, you know, all my conservative friends who, mm-hmm. they say the Jews and the liberals are running all the papers. They don't tell me that this is communism and this is, mm-hmm. you know, if they take over, you know the argument.
Yeah. So. Well, there's no doubt Nicaragua is Marxist. There's no doubt about it. I don't think Nicaragua is communist in any way. Nicaragua is Marxist because it controls the banks and it controls imports and exports. And in that way, they can control the economy, they can control what is produced, where it is produced, and who it's distributed to. It's tough to say what would happen in El Salvador if a revolution took place. I know the Nicaraguan people feel very close to the revolution in El Salvador because it is much like their revolution. But it would be difficult to say what would happen when a new government comes into El Salvador.
Is the common man's lot, though, better? In
Nicaragua?
Yes.
All the people we talked to thought so. They were quite pleased with the revolution. People were beaming. People would want to talk about it. There are many, many physical signs that something different is happening. And no, the people on the street are not disappointed with the revolution. Now, there are people that are disappointed with the revolution. I'm not trying to say that 100% of the people believe in this revolution, because that's simply not true. There are people that are against the revolution.
Why?
One person I talked to, his major complaint was that during the Somoza years, he could buy meat anytime he wanted to, and during these years he cannot. Now, I'm not saying that that's everybody's argument. I think there are more sophisticated arguments than that. But rationing is one thing that people that have wealth don't want to do, just like I don't think we want to do it.
Kirk, could you comment on some of the political leaders that were pro-revolution and have since changed sides?
Mm-hmm. There are some revolutionary leaders who were with the revolution and after the insurrection or during the insurrection, they went to Honduras, they went to Costa Rica. They said that this government is no longer keep holding the principles that we founded it on. We talked to one person who was a good friend of Eden Pastoras and who was released in 1978 when the Sandinistas took over the Congress building and asked release of prisoners. She was released with him and was a personal friend of his. She thought that in his particular case, his problem was that he thought he couldn't be, well, he thought that he could never be replaced. And that's one thing Nicaragua doesn't want. That government did not want that. They didn't want to make one person that would be everyone who would be looking to, such as a Fidel Castro, where we identify the government with one person. Nicaragua doesn't want to make a hero like that. She thought that Pastor thought that he couldn't be, that there would be no way that they could do without him. And there was no way that this new government could stand something like that. And she thought Pastor left because he saw that he wasn't going to get a lion's share of the power. That was her. Go ahead.
Well, speaking of that point, is what type of constitution is there and what provision is there for change in government mm-hmm. along the lines of the checks and balances to keep one from being more powerful than another?
Okay. The government, I wonder if I should write this down. The government is led by a three-man junta, which is the equivalent to our president. Then here is a nine-person directorate. and these are members of the prevailing party in Nicaragua, the FSLN. And then here, we have a Congress, what our equivalent of Congress would be. And in this Congress, every group in Nicaragua is represented by a various number of seats. Groups from the Catholic Church to women's groups to the Communist Party, all sorts of groups. In 1985, Nicaragua will have elections. This summer, the Congress is deciding what they are going to elect. No one knows whether they're going to elect another 9 persons, another 3 persons, another Congress. No one knows yet. So that's the government set up. These people have the power, these three. And the checks and balances are somewhat like our own. Brief, but...
Are there really checks and balances? In the Soviet Union, the Congress has the same description. Uh-huh. The 9-person directorate is the Politburo, and the Junta is the President of Presidium, and etc. And of course, the power flows from the top down. The Congress is, in fact, stamped. Is that true in Nicaragua also?
Well, I think it's true right now. I think the power does flow down from the top, or at least from here and here. And although the power for elections is going to be here, I think that is true. And that's why I would never say that this revolution is perfect, because there certainly is a way that it could be exploited by a few people. And that's why I think we shouldn't be toying with this revolution as Americans, because there is, it could be easily destabilized and be sent to the left or wherever. And no, this can be exploited, there's no doubt about it. Right now, I think they're doing a good job, and right now they're trying to arm the people, and they see that as one way of keeping the government honest. If everyone has a gun, you keep the government pretty honest.
I'm a little bit concerned that I'm hearing more and more reports that there is dissatisfaction with the rulers or the government in Nicaragua. And I'm concerned that maybe the U.S. already has distorted what they're doing enough that they are on the defensive, they're concerned about information flow, about that sort of thing, and that maybe it's already gone so far that the government, that the revolution really kind of has been negated.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any feelings
yeah.
about that?
Before I left for Nicaragua, I was extremely worried. I don't see any way that Nicaragua can survive with the United States working against Nicaragua. I think Nicaragua can survive if the United States leaves it alone. And so before I left, I was very worried about that same question, that there's no way this thing can work. There's absolutely no way. I think after one's been in Nicaragua for about 2 days, you get the general feeling that, well, there's still a euphoria for the revolution. And people are really for it, and they keep on saying, we will fight to the death. It's revolution or death. And I think the people we talk to are satisfied with the revolution. Now, granted, I didn't talk to a lot of the people that are in the upper crust, and I would say that they generally are not satisfied with the revolution. But the masses of the people couldn't be happier with it. They've got land, they've got a job. And what more, considering what they've had for the last 45 years, that they consider that doing well. Go ahead.
You mentioned that 65% of the economy is still in the hands of the private sector.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the long-range program of the present Junta to continue that policy, or do they intend to take over completely?
No, they don't. They don't plan to leave it at 65%, but no, they don't plan to take it all over. Nicaragua saw after the revolution that there was no way they could control the whole economic system and still continue to produce, to generate dollars so that they could keep their government running. So what they decided to do was leave the private sector alone, let them produce, start the government sector, get them producing, and then when they're both producing at their highest level, they'll begin to mesh them. What the government sees is eventually the private sector will control 30% of the economy. And then individual peasants will control 5% of the economy, state cooperatives will control 40%, and then state farms, which are different from cooperatives, will control another 20, or excuse me, co-ops will control 40%, and state farms will control 25%. And in that mixture, basically an agricultural economy, with that mixture of agricultural economy, that's how the economy will run. So yes, there will be less and less private sector control. But right now, they see the private sector as the only way that they can generate dollars to keep their government and their economy running.
It's still voluntary then, as far as state farms are concerned, who goes on state farms or whether they have their own private farm.
Indeed. But then again, many people were peasant farmers and things like that, so they can either work for their owners or they can join a state co-op. It is voluntary.
All co-ops are state-owned.
Co-ops are state-owned. No, there are private farms where unions are formed. You can work for a private farmer if you would like. We visited with some
produce
people.
Produce must go through the state co-ops.
Well, the state buys the produce, mm-hmm. or the state buys agricultural goods. And they, what's the word? Subsidize mm-hmm. basic staples.
What's your main export?
Main exports are cotton and coffee, some bananas, but that's where their dollars are generated.
Do we maintain?
They can't compete with the United States in cotton production.
Well, in actuality, let's see. Nicaragua improved all yields on cotton, on all crops except for cotton, which they improved by 67% over pre-1979 high. And that was better than the United States, Mexico, Guatemala, and El Salvador did since 1979. So, as far as, what does that say? That means they're improving more. That doesn't mean they're at the production level of the United States, but they're working hard to produce this. Oh, we have one right here.
Relationship with them. Do we have an ambassador there? Are they with us?
Yes, we have an ambassador in Nicaragua, and they have one there. We closed 6 consulates a week ago, but we still have an embassy, or Nicaragua still has an embassy in Washington. We have an ambassador and a full-blown embassy in Nicaragua.
Are we still talking?
We're still talking, but that's about it. We seem to exchange notes once in a while. They tell us every time an attack on the border comes, they give us a note and say, we don't like this. And then we come up with some peace proposals saying, if you stop the flow of arms to El Salvador, which we can't prove, we'll then negotiate with you. And Nicaragua says, if you could prove it, we'd start negotiating, then we'd stop it. But
what would happen if we close it completely in the communication to Nicaragua? What do you think would happen?
I think Nicaragua would turn to anyone else that would help them, and if that happens to be the Soviet Union, then it happens to be the Soviet Union. If it happens to be East Germany or West Germany or France, they'll go there too. Nicaragua is not worried. All they want to do is not become a puppet of one country. They don't want to be a puppet of the United States nor the Soviet Union. They want to be Nicaragua, and they would trade with us if we would like it. They'd even consider our missiles if we do that, just as they consider Soviet Union missiles. So they're just keeping their options open as they see it. Am I missing anyone up in the balcony? All right. Who is down here? Go ahead.
To what extent do you feel that Russia and Castro were involved in the revolution? And secondly, why won't a democratic form of government work in Nicaragua?
Mm, okay. The communist influence in Nicaragua or in any country is always a difficult question to ask, and probably even more difficult to answer. I don't think the people of Nicaragua were influenced to revolt against the Somoza governments because of the Soviet Union or because of Cuba, simply because of oppression, because they had finally had enough. That's why they revolted, I think. There's no doubt about it that there is Soviet-Cuban influence there. I saw several Russian tractors. Russia is a great trading partner. They are giving Nicaragua good terms to trade on wheat, on parts, on machinery. While during the 45 years of Somoza, the United States gave great terms for machinery. So Nicaragua is outfitted with United States machinery, and now with a parts blockade on Nicaragua, they can't repair any machine that they have. So they have to turn to anyone they can to keep production going, because if they don't produce, they don't get money. If they don't get money, they fail. The second question. Maybe a democratic government would work in Nicaragua. I think it takes more than 4 years to educate people in democracy. And I think the literacy campaign helped people be educated in the voting process. We come out of a history of voting. My parents voted, my grandparents voted, as did all of yours. In Nicaragua, nobody voted for 45 years, and before that, nobody voted either. So here we have a new government. You've got 2.5 million Nicaraguans who've never seen a ballot in their life. It might work, but it's going to take a period of time to educate people in those terms. It just doesn't happen overnight. I think that's part of the reason. Maybe a democratic government will work. Maybe it won't. I don't know.
How was the Congress elected?
The Congress was appointed by the various groups that they represent. The groups decide who is going to represent them in the Congress.
The
party decided who. They decided that any groups that were recognized as a legitimate group in Nicaragua would be represented in the Congress.
I'd like to question the way that we look at whether Nicaragua is a democracy now or not. There's a tendency to say that if they have elections, their democracy. And if they don't, they're not. I think Nicaragua is probably much more of a democracy without elections than El Salvador is with an election. So, and I just hate to be so critical of a government that has taken over from such an incredibly bad situation and done so many good things.
What's the population of Nicaragua?
It's about 2.8 million people. It's about the size of Iowa, a little larger, and fewer people than Iowa, just by a couple hundred thousand.
What was the feeling of the people that you talked to about the incident with the Pope and his visit?
The Pope did a lot of damage in Nicaragua. The people felt that if this is what our Pope is, forget the church, we don't need it. I think I read some of the things that were reported in American press services as to what happened in Nicaragua at the Mass in Managua. And the things that we heard in Nicaragua were very different from those that were reported in America, in the United States of America. It seemed, well, several young men were buried the day before the Pope came to Managua. They were killed on the northern border. Their mothers were in the front of the crowd at the Mass when the Pope said Mass in Managua. It's a very Central American thing to do, is to pray for the dead. That's just what they do. So these mothers were saying, pray for the dead, pray for the dead, and the Pope was ignoring them. one of the Pope's topics, not in the Managua Mass, but in León, was Christian education, you know, Christian Catholic education. And here he is in this country that's torn by war, has just come through a revolution, and he's talking about Christian education. It seems that the Pope could have been a little more in tune with what was happening there. But in Managua, these mothers began crying, "Pray for our dead." And the crowd began going with it, "Pray for our dead." And then the Pope shouts silence. The crowd begins to shout political slogans. It was not a good scene. I don't think the Pope handled it well. I think group dynamics had a lot to do with it. I think the Pope could have just prayed for the dead and it would have been over with. That's a Protestant speaking. But another thing, I also read several things about how the Pope had to do Mass without a cross in front of the revolutionary figures of Nicaragua, which was true. But there also was a huge billboard constructed of the Pope that was off to the left a little bit and down the ways. But that seemed to never make the American press.
Well, he was across to the cross. I mean, that was...
Well, organization of Catholic priests as well as the government coordinated the whole visit of the Pope. And I don't think the blame can solely lay on the Sandinista government for not having a cross there. You got Dick.
So from your analysis and study, what do you think this government's position ought to be in not only Nicaragua, but all of Central America? I don't see how you consider Central America from what little I know about it. I mean, you can't consider Nicaragua without considering the whole Central American situation. Mm-hmm. What ought we be telling our congressmen, our representatives, and our president that he ought to do? Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I'm sure I don't know.
Well, I think, first of all, for Nicaragua, I think we should leave him alone and let them do what they...
Let's expand on that. Now, how do you mean by leave them alone?
I think we should end covert activity against Nicaragua. We should try to assist the Nicaraguan government in any way we could. I think we still have the potential to create a very, very different kind of government, a very beautiful government in Central America, one that would be very, very different from any other government that we've ever seen there. I still think we have that possibility, but I don't think it can happen with us working against Nicaragua. That, I mean, working against Nicaragua by blocking loans in the world banks and by having allowing no parts, we've cut the sugar quota cut the sugar quota. That type of action does not help Nicaragua. If we would let Nicaragua continue to be what it wants to be instead of projecting our views of what it should be on Nicaragua, I think that would be much more helpful. I think we would make more friends if we would do it out of a mutual sharing relationship than by a relationship of clubbing them over the head and saying either do what we want or else. I think if we would leave Nicaragua alone, it would help Nicaragua. In El Salvador and in Guatemala, it seems that we are holding governments in power that are not for the people. President Reagan often says about El Salvador that the people are not in support of this government. It is a country very, very small, as you can see, 5 million people, highest density in Central America. There's no way that Marxist bands can run around El Salvador without the people's support. It's just not possible. There isn't enough room for them to hide. I think we are on the wrong side of this conflict. We are perpetrating our hidden agendas and not the peoples of Central America's agendas. That's as I see it.
Thank you.